KBOO Community Radio is proud to host a class, Hip Hop Past, Present, and Future, and Your Place in It, with Mike Crenshaw, Saturday, April 16th at 4 p.m. here at KBOO in Portland. This class will explore hip hop history locally, nationally, and at KBOO. We'll explore how hip hop influences art, culture, and political consciousness, and how rhyme writing, production, and liberation struggles have contributed to hip hop culture. Again, that's Hip Hop Past, Present, and Future, and Your Place in It, with Mike Crenshaw, Saturday, April 16th at 4 p.m., KBOO, 20 Southeast 8th Avenue, in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
Come on, play some blues now. KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the Inner City Blues Festival on Saturday, April 21st from 5:30 to midnight at the North Portland Eagles Lodge in Portland. For the past 7 years, the Inner City Blues Festival has focused on healing the healthcare blues, supporting Oregon's universal healthcare movement. Performers this year include the Norman Sylvester Review with Sarah Billings and Leanne Miller, the King Louis Payne Quartet and LaRonda Steele, and many, many more. Again, that's the Inner City Blues Festival on Saturday, April 21st from 5:30 to midnight at the North Portland Eagles Lodge, 7611 North Exeter Avenue at Lombard in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
This is KBOO Portland. It's 9:01 a.m. and time for the beloved community, looking at the rising threats to free speech, Muslim-Christian dialogue, and LGBTQ plus advocacy. So we're just going to get right to that.
Of nonviolence is the creation of the beloved community. The aftermath of nonviolence is redemption. The aftermath of nonviolence is reconciliation. The aftermath of violence, however, is bitterness. And this is the thing I'm concerned about. Let us fight passionately and unrelentingly for the goal of justice and freedom. But let's be sure that our hands are clean in the struggle. Let us never fight with falsehood and violence and hate and malice, but always fight with love, so that when the day comes that the walls of segregation have completely crumbled in Montgomery, that we will be able to live with people as our brothers and sisters.
902, and this is KBOO Portland. Good morning, I'm John Shack, and this is the Beloved Community Resources for Activism. You hear the Beloved Community every second Friday on KBOO from 9 to 10 a.m. And I'm glad we have a big show here. Last month was kind of a fun drama here. My guest was canceled by staff. That decision is being appealed. But the show goes on today, and I have four very important guests. Jeremy Roth-Kuschel is on the phone with me. He was arrested in a library in Kansas City, Missouri, for free speech. The librarian came to defend him, and he was arrested. We got that exciting story coming up. And that's going to be our first story. Then I also have with me in the studio Lynn Neely from the Workers' World Party, and she's going to talk about a big action that is happening across the country, including tomorrow in Portland against U.S. wars at home and abroad. We're going to talk about that. Also with me is Brett Webb Mitchell, and Brett is an openly gay Presbyterian minister, pastor of the Community of Pilgrims Presbyterian Church in Portland, and just been named the LGBTQ plus advocacy coordinator for the Oregon-Idaho Conference of the United Methodist Church, and so we're going to talk about that important work. And then I also have Nicole Carreri, and she is one of the leading speakers in the country, really, on behalf of Shia Islam, and she's going to talk about her work in Christian-Muslim relations. And that's really what she's going to talk about. So that's coming up later this morning. So we're waiting for a phone call, hoping to connect with Jeremy. Is that all right? So he's going to be coming up in just a second. But you know, while we wait for Jeremy, one of the beautiful things about radio is that we can make some switches around. So let's go ahead and start with you, Lynn. Do you mind getting right up there? Let's put Lynn on the red microphone. Welcome.
Thank you. Thank you for having me, John.
Lynn Neely is a member of the Workers' World Party. And I know nothing about you except for your email that I happen to see on a website about a big action tomorrow, the United Day of Action Against U.S. Wars at Home and Abroad. So tell us a little bit about that. When and where, first of all, in Portland?
Okay, it's tomorrow, Saturday, at at Waterfront Park, the War Memorial, the Battleship Memorial. It's at 1 o'clock. And it's going to be a rally, with 12 speakers.
Oh, 12 speakers. Who are some of those speakers? Do you know?
Yeah, people talking about different countries and addressing the lies that the media is spreading about countries like Syria, Venezuela, the Philippines, the DPRK, the Ukraine, and Yemen. And then we have a dynamic community organizer from Don't Shoot Portland, Black Lives Matter, who's going to talk about the war on our communities and the need to build ties between people in communities and neighborhoods to defend ourselves against the racist police in the state, which is also, you know, a war of aggression.
So these are wars at home and abroad
The
focus of this.
Right.
Who started this? Who set this up?
A group called UNAC, the United National Anti-War Coalition. And there's huge demonstrations in big cities across the country. And Portland's going to also, we're going to have one here. So Workers' World is part of UNAC.
Yeah. Okay. So it's going to start there at the Waterfront Park, and there's going to be speeches there, and then it's going to be a march to Saturday Market. Is that right?
Yes. Afterwards, we have a leaflet that has some facts about Syria, alternate facts that you won't get on the media, normal media, that we're going to hand out to people at Saturday Market. Yeah.
Tell me about some of these alternate facts and what are some of the things. What Syria, it's right in the news right now of whether
right.
or not Trump's sending tweets about how tough he is, and then he backs off a little
right.
bit. And what's the situation?
Well, we've heard this before. I mean, they've talked about chemical weapons. Every time that Syria begins to win the war against the U.S.-backed every time the Syrian army advances its fight against imperialist-backed terrorist groups, the U.S. cries chemical weapons. And like in Iraq, weapons of mass destruction, they found there were none, you know. So where's the proof? There is no proof. But there is the Organization for the Prohibition of Chemical Weapons has confirmed that Syria does not have chemical weapons, and they don't have weapons of mass destruction. This is a 7-year war that the U.S. has been waging on Syria, and they haven't won yet. So they're trying to get their allies to go with them to invade Syria again, but they're losing. The empire is crumbling, and they're not. Yeah.
And we have wars not only in Syria, but you also mentioned Yemen. Of course, we've had Afghanistan and Iraq since this millennium has started. We've had continuous ongoing war.
We have an endless war because, you know, we need markets. There was a study put out by the Defense Department that states, Joint Chiefs of Staff, they did a lot of research and they came up with the conclusion that there's a fundamental change going on that can't be ignored in our own peril. At our own peril. That's a quote from them. Another quote from their study was that the international order established by the U.S. after World War II is collapsing. Throughout the study, they used words like global hegemony is unraveling and fraying and in decline. So the U.S. is threatened. The study also said that the U.S. is threatened by an uncontrolled spread of information. So access to technology is undermining the advantages that imperialism had in the past to wage these discrete, secret, covert wars and spread propaganda trying to convince the American people that that Saddam Hussein is a dictator. 72% of the people in Syria voted for Hussein, and they have the right to self-determination, and we do not.
You mean Assad?
I mean Assad. I'm sorry. we don't have the right to go in and bomb them. You know, they have the right to self-determination.
Well, I heard Assad may be a bad guy, but the U.S. getting involved does not make it better.
Right.
Anyway, so this is going to happen. The rally is going to happen all over the country, including in Portland tomorrow again at 1 o'clock.
Yes.
What should people bring besides perhaps rain gear?
An open mind and some questions and their enthusiasm to try to turn this imperialism around.
Now, I want a website for perhaps your website or information about this. Where would they go?
We're on Workers' World Party PDX on Facebook.
World Workers' Party PDX, and check it on Facebook.
Workers' World Party.
Workers' World Party.
Party PDX.
Thank you.
John.
Lynn Neely, thanks so much for being with me.
Yeah, thanks a lot.
We're going to go right now on the phone to Jeremy Roth-Kushel. Jeremy, are you there?
I'm here.
Jeremy, welcome to the Beloved Community.
Thank you so much for having me, John.
Well, you are an exciting guy. Involved in, on May 9th, the story, this is what I've got from a quick story here. On May 9th, 2016, the Kansas City Public Library hosted an event called Truman and Israel, featuring the Washington Institute for Near East Policy distinguished fellow Dennis Ross, and sponsored by the library, the Truman Library Foundation, and the Jewish Community Center in Kansas City several years Foundation of Greater Kansas City. There was a shooting at the Jewish Community Center in Kansas City several years back, and so the library agreed to allow off-duty police to be on the scene. Two conditions were set by the library. Nobody could be forcibly removed for asking an unpopular question, and nobody could be removed at all without consulting the library staff, who would only allow an individual to be removed if staff concluded they were an imminent threat. So, in addition to off-duty police officers, private security guards associated with the JCF, the Jewish Community Center, were present. And in spite of these precautions, a local peace activist, Jeremy Roth-Kushel, was removed. And when the librarian, Steve Wolfolk, tried to sort things out, he was arrested. So, and then you, Jeremy, were subsequently arrested for trespassing and resisting arrest. So, what? Tell us in your words what happened on that day, May 9th, 2016.
Yes, as you said, that there was this previous event, a shooting outside of a Jewish community center 2 years earlier, I believe, by a known entity, a neo-Nazi white supremacist type who had been a former FBI informant. And after that, the local organization on this evening of May 9th, it was the Jewish Community Foundation, was the sponsor. They were then brought in a new security director that had been brought in by Homeland Security and an organization called SCAN, Secure Community Network, that has been called by the head of the Jewish Federations of North America as, quote, our Jewish Homeland Security. And this man, Blair Hawkins, was actually in charge of the security that evening because the library felt sympathy towards the Jewish community in the wake of those shootings and wanted everyone to feel safe, but they also have their own ethical and legal commitments to the First Amendment, and so they wanted to make sure that it was understood that people would not have force used against them because of speech, viewpoint, and that's ultimately what ended up happening. And I had RSVP'd to this event that, like you said, it's Truman in Israel, co-sponsored by Jewish Community Foundation, Truman Library Institute, and the Kansas City Public Library. And it was meant to celebrate the anniversary of the birth of Israel and Truman's quick recognition of it. And after the presentation by Dennis Ross, who, like you said, is part of the Washington Institute for Near East Policy, it's a spin-off organization of APAC, the American Israel Public Affairs Committee, seen as the most foremost organization of the Israel lobby and has been involved in spy scandals. And Ross himself is seen in many ways as he's sort of seen as in the middle, but he's actually has a fairly harsh foreign policy when it comes down to it. And so after his presentation, they opened up the floor for questions and answers. And I was the first one up at the microphone. And I brought in a few pieces of historical facts that I had just actually become aware of, one of them, which is that according to Truman's daughter's Margaret's book, the Stern Gang, also known as Lehi, one of the proto-Israeli terrorist groups that was involved also in the Deir Yassin massacre, of which I believe we just passed the 70th anniversary of more than 100 innocent Palestinians slaughtered by aspects of the Irgun and the Stern Gang. The Stern Gang had sent mail bombs to Truman in the year before Truman recognized Israel. And so I brought that into the mix. I brought the King David Hotel bombing, in which I believe Irgun was also involved. It was proto-Israeli terrorist forces targeting mainly British forces, including people who were murdered were also Jews in that. So, and then finally, I finished it up with by putting on the table my awareness of things like September 11th. And then I claimed as a Jewish American that both the governments that operate in my name have a long-term history of utilizing basically state-sponsored terrorism, including against the people that they're meant to protect, Jews and Americans, let's say, in terms of the United States and Israel, and utilizing it for their own geopolitical interests at home and abroad. They said, when are we going to stand up and be ethical Jews and Americans?
So you're giving this response to Dennis Ross, and while you're talking, what happened?
There was a back and forth with Dennis Ross a little bit, and he threw in a couple lines, a couple of zinger lines, including you're allowed your own opinion, but you're not allowed your own facts based on Senator Daniel Patrick Moynihan, and then I leaned back to the microphone to respond and put some facts that I knew about the apparent fraudulent nature of the war on terror and its use in perpetrating aggressive warfare based on the overall fraud of September 11th, to put that on the record. And then I was grabbed from behind on my upper left arm with no apparent warning by the head of security that I identified before, Blair Hawkins, who has a very deep background, actually, in terms of the national security so-called apparatus. He apparently was guarding Karzai in Afghanistan after the U.S. invasion there, and has worked all throughout the national security apparatus before being given this job at the with the Jewish community in the Kansas City area.
Okay, so he grabbed you to remove you, and then what happened?
And then a off-duty detective named Brent Parsons joined into that as the librarian Steve Wufolk, who had actually helped organize the event, had allowed the Jewish Community Foundation to bring the extra security in the first place, came in to remind them of the setting here and that there were rules at the library about grabbing people and that that we could handle this in a nonviolent fashion.
So the librarian then didn't think you were doing anything wrong or being disruptive or an imminent threat?
No, he thought that it was completely in line with what they allow and even encourage in terms of vigorous discourse at the library. And I was also I passed my camera off to my friend Greg McCarron, who was filming, and we were actually searched on the way in. There was only us women that I believe were searched on the way in of over 500 people, and I had RSVP'd for the event, so there is some indication that I was actually targeted for extra attention and search on the way in. So when I was searched by a uniformed sergeant of the Kansas City Police Department on the way in, I made it very clear that I'm on the public record of asking questions of public officials that some of them find uncomfortable, and that I intended to do both pursue both speech and press functions at the event that evening. And I was then allowed in saying, well, you're fully within your right to do that. So security knew that I was both had a background and that I had intention that evening to pursue both speech and press functions, not to mention the assembly that was happening in place.
They eventually hustled you out of the room, did they?
Yes. Yeah, so then I made it very clear that I was willing to leave if they asked me at that point, because and I also said I was very clear that I did not want to be touched. So I said, get your hands off of me. I will leave if asked. You can ask me to leave. And at that point, the librarian had intervened in a nonviolent way to basically so that everybody had gotten their hands off of me. And so we finally then walked out. I was not being grabbed at that point. And then we went and grabbed my stuff, and we all left the venue and went moved to the lobby, where we were then confronted without identification by police officers who were in the lobby. And then the librarian, Steve Wufolk, was grabbed from behind with no warning or any announcement of any type of arrest going on.
These police here are on-duty police by this time, right? Or
these are all off-duty police.
They're all off-duty.
There were two uniformed off-duty police, and there was non-uniformed off-duty police, and then this private security guard were part of this four-member security, so-called contingent.
So in the end, both you and the librarian Steve Wufolk were ended up being arrested, and charges were pressed, and they continue to press these charges, right? The city.
The city continued to press the charges until last year. So we were both under indictment for over a year. They eventually dropped the charges on me. It looked like it was in response to me pursuing evidence that was okayed by the judge to gain in terms of discovery evidence about emails from the prosecutor's office, potentially in relationship to some of the other parties, including the Jewish Community Foundation. And in response to that, there was some type of non-official agreement to drop the charges. But ultimately, they even escalated the charges against Steve Wufolk, the librarian, even in the midst of when he was getting national awards and his library was getting national awards for their protection of basic free speech rights and the importance of some of the programming they were doing. And then Steve actually ultimately went to trial in last September of 2017, and he was acquitted on all three charges.
Jeremy Roth-Kruschel, if you're just joining us, is my guest. He's talking about being arrested in the library for exercising his free speech rights. Now, so the case right now, so both of the charges by the city against you and the librarian have been dismissed. Do you have a civil case going on?
Not yet, but I am investigating that, and that is in process because there was very fundamental free speech rights that were violated, fundamental press rights that were violated, and even assembly. And there was some even indication that there was some bias towards what type of activist and what kind of Jewish person I am. Because even in the police report by the arresting officer, a detective, Brent Parsons, and I forgot to mention that the commonality between the two main actors here in terms of this so-called arrest, the head of security, Hawkins, and the off-duty detective, Parsons, was not only had they both been sent to Israel on training junkets of some sort, but they also both met at the local Department of Homeland Security Fusion Center. So it appears that there was some type of targeting involved. And so on the police report by Parsons about my alleged crimes, he actually put a bias code, a 21 anti-Jewish bias code on my trespassing charge, and basically said that he believed that I was driven by anti-Jewish bias, even though I very clearly identified myself as a Jewish American, and I said nothing that would could be seen as anything about Jewish people per se. I referenced very specific geopolitical concepts in my statement and my question, things like geopolitical cause, state sponsored terrorism, the United States, Israel. So there is also apparently some type of religious political dynamic that's been packaged into this violation of the totality of the First Amendment.
Jeremy Roth-Kruschel, my guest on the Beloved Community. Well, look at the bigger picture here. Is there a connection between censorship and perhaps between Zionism itself? I'm thinking of the BDS movement and laws that are being posted to try to restrict boycotting Israel. For example, even here at in Portland, the smear campaign against my potential guest, Kevin Barrett, and this library incident. Is the censoring of views critical of Israel on the rise?
It really does appear that way. And I call myself a Jewish American patriot of conscience. And I would say that Dr. Kevin Barrett, who was ousted from the American Academy for questioning Zionist narratives, would be called a Muslim American patriot of conscience. And there is an escalation of using charges of anti-Semitism. So in a way, I was actually accused of an anti-Semitically driven trespassing charge, even though the ethical core of my question is, why do we allow states that operate in our names as Jews and Americans to kill the people, including Jews and Americans, in terms of staged fraudulent state-sponsored terrorism to pursue dynamics of power? And it's very clear in terms of what we've been seeing in terms of the escalation in Texas in the wake of the hurricane. We saw people who were going to have to sign a commitment to not participate in Palestinian solidarity through boycott, divestment, sanction in order to get federal help. I believe that was maybe eventually done away with. But here in Kansas, we had a young Mennonite woman math teacher who was not going to be allowed to get a contract to teach math at the state level because she was also unwilling, because of her own conscience, to sign the pledge not to participate in boycott, divestment, sanctions. The good side of that is the ACLU has participated with her legally in pushing that back to the state legislature here in Kansas so that individuals can't be targeted in that way. But it is clear over the history of the Zionist movement that not only is there the weapon of the charge of anti-Semitism used to try to suppress both uncomfortable facts, but also some of the truth tellers that speak those uncomfortable facts. But if you actually look at the very origins of some of the early Zionist leaders, they also welcomed real anti-Semitism, real anti-Jewishness as one of their best friends. And this is also why we see that in the early days of Israel, aspects of what we might call the Israeli deep state staged terror bombings all throughout the Middle East against Jewish targets to try to drive Jewish people to Israel. And so one last thing on this point is that we also see the allegedly grassroots Jewish organizations such as the so-called Anti-Defamation League, which is actually an arm of the global Masonic organization B'nai B'rith, that had high-level elements that were involved in the Confederate intelligence and leadership and apparently helped set up the Ku Klux Klan in the wake of the Civil War. And then in the 20th century, we see the so-called Anti-Defamation League being involved in spying on people like Reverend Martin Luther King Jr., the most important proponent of the important concept of the beloved community. And this was only 30 years later that Henry Schwarzschild, a former ADL employee, confirmed to the San Francisco Weekly that the ADL had spied on King because they thought that he was a loose cannon. He was a Baptist preacher, and nobody could quite sure know what he was going to do next. And there is even some inkling that he and some of his compatriots were turning towards Arab and Palestinian solidarity in the years running up to his state-sponsored murder, as found in a civil suit by the King family lawyer, Dr. William Pepper, in the late 90s. And last thing about the ADL is that they say that they speak on behalf of the Jewish people. When I was accused of a crime that I did not commit, in order to try to silence my ethical speech about difficult historical facts about not only my own country, the United States, but the Jewish state of Israel, no Jewish organization came to reach out to me, and especially the ADL did not. And the ADL has been found to have been involved in spying on not only on Palestinian solidarity activists, but also on anti-apartheid activists in the 80s, and using operatives inside of the San Francisco Police Department to get out information on anti-racist activists, anti-apartheid activists. So this is really what it looks like, that many of the charges of anti-Semitism are really on behalf of what has become an intensely violent and illegitimate use of state power from Israel.
Jeremy Rothkoschel, we're just about out of time. My guest here on and the library, however, back to that story, was awarded what, the Lemony Snicket Award, right, for protecting free speech.
Yes, correct. They won the Lemony Snicket Award for courageous protection of free speech, and they very much deserve it. Steve Wufolk, the librarian, has been an actor of very good faith in all of this and has told the truth all along the way. And immediately all he wanted was an apology for an apparent misunderstanding. But the forces surrounding the arrest and who sponsored the arrest have not only been unwilling to offer up a simple apology about their obvious disruption, violent disruption of a peaceful library event by their so-called security people, but have doubled down on not telling the truth about what actually happened.
Jeremy Rothkoschel, thank you for being with me, and I appreciate that. And now, if people want to find out information about you and what all the things that you've talked about, do you have a website?
They can go look at The Antidote on YouTube, ANTEDOTE, and check me out with Dr. Kevin Barrett every Friday morning on False Flag Weekly News on No Lies Radio.
Jeremy Rothkoschel, thanks for being with me.
Okay, thank you so much, John.
This is KBOO. This is The Beloved Community. It's 9:31, and when we come back, I'm going to talk with Brett Webb Mitchell. He is an openly gay Presbyterian minister, director of the Community of Pilgrims Presbyterian Church in Portland, and has been named as the LGBTQ+ Advocacy Coordinator for the Oregon-Idaho Conference of the United Methodist Church. That's coming right up. And then Nicole Carreri, who is a Shia Muslim speaker. She'll be on the phone with me to talk about Shia Islam and the legacy of Imam Hussein.
Jeremiah was a bullfrog, was a good friend of mine.
Need a little Three Dog Night. This is The Beloved Community. I'm John Schuck. Welcome to KBOO. In the studio is a friend of mine and a colleague, Brett Webb Mitchell. He's a Presbyterian minister, pastor of Community of the Pilgrims Presbyterian Church here in Portland. All right, here's the deal. Does the world need another church? Or shall I put it another way? Does Portland need the Community of Pilgrims?
I think the Portland needs the community of Pilgrims Presbyterian Fellowship, because what we're trying to do and be is a community that is following Jesus but embracing all. And I think what's unique is that we're really struggling and striving and seeking to encourage everyone to come. There's a history in Portland of being a largely white community, and so we tend to be, in many of our Presbyterian churches, we tend to include many people who happen to be Anglo and straight and happen to be middle class. And so what we're trying to do...
We Presbyterians are a bit waspish.
We are. We have that edge to ourselves. And so what we're trying to do in starting a new faith community is to create a community and relationships. And from that, our worshiping life, our life of service, our life of prayer, our life of being in relationship with one another grows. And so that's what's kind of been unique, is that we're starting afresh, being openly gay, welcoming people who are LGBTQ and straight, welcoming people from all races, ethnicities, nationalities, welcoming of all ages, socioeconomic brackets, those who are coming from the hearing community and those from the deaf community, as well as those who self-identify as able-bodied or disabled. We're welcoming all, and it's giving us a fresh new start, and it's something that it's kind of neat, because, again, we're building a community, and from that we worship, we serve, we take care of others.
You know, and there are many open churches. I could consider myself a pastor of one, but I'm not an openly gay Presbyterian minister, and I don't know how many there are in Portland.
There's one,
and that, and I'm looking at him.
That's it.
So, I mean, but that's important, right?
Right.
I mean, to have a community, and that gives the movement credibility.
It does. And I think that's what we're trying to do, is in the Presbyterian Church, what we've been able to do with the change in our Book of Order, we've been able to include LGBTQ people who are openly so, and in relationship, married relationship, and without fear of any kind of retribution. So what the United Methodist Church is trying to do now, especially in this, the Oregon-Idaho United Methodist Church Conference, is also be inclusive of all. And there's a change afoot. I mean, this conference, the Oregon-Idaho United Methodist Church Conference, has been on the cutting edge of being inclusive. Wilshire United Methodist Fellowship is welcoming of a largely urban Indian population. Hughes Memorial has served a historically African-American neighborhood. There are two Hispanic ministry churches, Las Naciones, as well as Epworth United Methodist Church, a Japanese-American church in Northeast Portland, and so, and Tongan Ministry. So this conference has had a kind of edginess to it, has kind of been called by Christ to follow a gospel that's all-inclusive. So alongside the largely ethnic, diverse congregations that they've set up, they were gifted with some funds from the Collins Foundation, who challenged the United Methodist Church to be more inclusive, to welcome LGBTQ people, both in the role not only as members of their congregations, but also in the role of leadership. And so that's kind of where I came into this, is that the Collins Foundation made it possible for me to fulfill a role that had been open this year, and that was to be the LGBTQ advisory coordinator in working with churches and working with clergy and working with the queer clergy here in the United Methodist Oregon-Idaho Conference. And so it, in a sense, John, it's kind of been a wonderful blend of being a minister that's able to serve two different denominations, but with the same goal of being inclusive of all.
Well, I was going to talk about that mixing, that blending of two different kinds of materials,
right?
Presbyterian and Methodist.
Right, right. Well, and what's nice is I grew up as a United Methodist, and so I have a background in that area and taught at Duke Divinity School and had even more background. And my partner himself was a former United Methodist wannabe clergy person. And so I have that history in my own background, and so that's kind of what made it an interesting kind of fit, was to be called by the United Methodist Church to go ahead and serve in this capacity as being a coordinator and to advocate and to be an advisor to the Oregon-Idaho Conference in welcoming all. And it's new, because even in the structure of the Presbyterian Church USA, there is no position, nor is there in the ELC, the Evangelical Lutheran Church, United Church of Christ, and so on.
Oh, that's important. This is the only denomination, the Methodists are a conference here, not even the denomination, right. It's just this conference
right.
that has had such a position.
Right. This is the only conference. And just to remember, this is the United Methodist Church is a worldwide denomination. And so it is incredibly brave of them to have an openly gay minister who is there in a role for those who are self-identified as lesbian, gay, bisexual, trans, queer, and questioning.
So tell me a little bit, final question there, about information, how people might be able to find your congregation.
Right. What they can do if they want to find and join us with the Community of Pilgrims Presbyterian Fellowship is just go on to communityofpilgrims.com. For more information regarding the United Methodists, go on to umoi.org, and they can find my information there and what we're doing.
All right. Brett Webb Mitchell, thanks for being with me. Thanks for all you're doing.
I appreciate it, John.
When I come back, I'm going to speak with Nicole Carreri. She is a leading speaker on Shia Islam, and she also graduated from Hartford Seminary in Christian-Muslim relations, and she's working on her PhD, and she's going to be talking about Christian-Muslim relations as well as the legacy of Imam Hussein next on The Beloved Community. There's Bruce Springsteen, Waiting on a Sunny Day. This is KBOO Portland. It's 941. This is The Beloved Community. I'm John Shuck, and I'm on the phone with Nicole Carreri. She is a public speaker on behalf of Shia Islam. In her bio, she writes that her work stems out of the gap she felt and observed for the English-speaking Muslims in the West to make sense of religion in their context and their lived realities. She's interested in an intellectual and inspirational approach to faith, and articulates a practical theology with a sensibility for social, gender, and ethical justice. Nicole is also committed to inter- and intra-faith work. She completed a master's degree in Islamic studies and Christian-Muslim relations at Hartford Seminary, and has been accepted into the PhD program in the religion department at Boston University. Welcome, Nicole, to the Beloved Community.
Thank you, and welcome. And I'm really glad to be welcomed, rather, to this program. It's really great to join you all.
You converted to Islam. Is that right? Would you be willing to share some of that story?
Well, that's the most common question every convert gets, and it's one that really speaks to the heart of what Islam is about. Islam is really something that is open to anyone and any place and time. And anyone can become Muslim. And one of the goals of Islam, or one of the ideals, is to be part of what's called this global ummah, or this global community. And so many people come to the religion, like myself, with the hopes of being part of this grand idea and this kind of ideal sense of community, really. So that is a very common question. One of the things that brought me to this faith was the theology. It really made sense to me. And Shia Islam in particular was very relevant, in the sense that I found out about different individuals like Ali, who we consider the successor to the Prophet Muhammad, and Imam Hussein's story in particular. And I felt that these individuals really represented people who tried to stay on that path of Islam, and they became the oppressed. And I really understood and felt for their story.
On April 28th, you're going to be speaking at the Red Lion Inn in Bellevue, Washington for Hussein Day, and I'm speaking with you at that conference. That's how I got connected with you, and I'm excited about meeting you there. But tell us a little bit about Imam Hussein. Who was he, and why is he important to you?
Well, it's a very important story, and it's one that even many Muslims who consider themselves Sunni today don't even know much about. So we see that just about 50 years after the death of the Prophet, and we often say, may peace and blessings be upon him, there are political battles going on for power and control. And it turns out that this group called the Umayyads, who were actually the descendants of one of the arch rivals of the Prophet during the Prophet's lifetime, ended up becoming those in power. And in the process, the people of the community wanted Hussein to come and be their spiritual leader or imam, which is the word that you've used a couple times. And so the people in the town of Kufa, in what we know as Iraq today, invited Hussein and his family and his companions to come to the city for him to establish himself as the spiritual leader and imam of that town. And in the process of his journey, he was ambushed by the leader of the time and the troops that surrounded him. The leader at that time was Yazid ibn Muawiyah ibn Sufyan, Sufyan again being that original arch rival of the Prophet. And not only was he ambushed, but they were cut off from water, they were maltreated, they were forced to give what is called bayah or allegiance to Yazid to basically give their support to him as the spiritual leader of Islam of the time, and they refused to do that because they felt that Yazid was not the legitimate representative of the religion. And so they stood their ground and fought a very dramatic battle against quite a huge opposition. And in that period, which we call Ashura, or the day of the event is Ashura, the first 10 days of the month of Muharram, is when he and his companions and family were attacked. They were martyred, and then those who remained alive, mainly the women and children and some other male relatives, were kept as captives. And they were paraded through various towns. And basically, there was a huge political agenda against them, saying that these were usurpers who were rebels. And it was actually the sister of Imam Hussein, Zainab, who I intend to be speaking about at the conference quite a bit, who made sure that this political message was clear, that they were the family of the Prophet, that they had been the victims of oppression, and that they were there to support the path of Islam and not be rebels.
And one of the attributes then of Hussein and those of you've mentioned was their fearless courage for standing up for what they believed is to be right. Is that would you say that's the case?
Oh, absolutely. And that's what's so enduring about the story of Imam Hussein. That's so inspiration to many people. You know, Gandhi was inspired by the 72 martyrs who died with him on the plains of Karbala, and he actually used that number 72 for his famous salt marches against the imperialistic, you know, British Empire. So that's fascinating. We also have many other references from historians. Brown is one of them, famous historians from England, who also quotes the story of Imam Hussein and says how much sacrifice he went through and how it's so moving what he did, even though the odds were completely against him, how he stood his ground. He truly was like the Braveheart of his time. He really stood up and stood for his principles, for the protection of the religion of Islam, and for it not to be usurped by individuals who were simply playing political games.
I'm speaking with Nicole Carreri on The Beloved Community. She's a public speaker on behalf of Shia Islam. Now, you have a master's degree in Christian-Muslim relations at Hartford Seminary. That's a Disciples of Christ seminary. I'm not sure what the affiliation is there.
It's a non-denominational seminary, and I'm actually going to be graduating this May.
This May you're going to graduate. Well, congratulations.
Yeah. Thank you. Just finished my thesis. But one of the most interesting things about Hartford Seminary is our interfaith commitment. And there are a number of different programs, including my master's program, and the fact that we have Muslim students and an Islamic studies program at the Institute, as well as Christian denominations and Jewish denomination as well.
So that was a positive experience then, studying with Christians and Jews?
Absolutely. I mean, I think in our time and place, we are redefining what various religious denominations really mean. And when you read my bio, that's one of the things that I personally am committed to, and I think people who are graduates of Hartford Seminary are committed to as well, and that is making religious life a practical experience, making it relevant, and making it meaningful today, and in an interfaith and a pluralistic society.
Who would you say, thinking about your studies, who are examples, both within Islam and within Christianity and within Judaism, of positive figures in dialogue and relations? Who should we emulate looking back through our history?
Well, that's a pretty...
maybe I put you on the spot question. There right away. But
yeah, you sure did. You know, one of the things that is so important is kind of... I'm going to just redirect the question. It's not so much who are good figures. I mean, there's plenty of great figures in terms of interfaith. It's more putting, you know, our religious values into practical realities and dealing with current life issues and social justice issues that are pressing today. I mean, it's interesting to note that I'm actually going to be going to BU, where Dr. Martin Luther King got his doctoral degree, which I find fascinating as well. But of course, the civil rights movement in and of itself is very much akin to the story of Imam Hussein. And so I see a lot of parallels there. And of course, with Dr. King's work and what he represented at his time, and taking faith, right, into action, and taking faith to be the way in which we uphold our principles in real life, putting it into practice. So not just worshiping or repeating rituals in private for the sake of ritualistic, tradition and or what we believe might be requirements, but to actually translate that into something practical. And I think that really fits well with the idea of this event we're going to be attending, which is the Imam Hussein, the Hussein Day, which is really geared towards being this interfaith event where people can come together and talk about how we have shared values, what our commitments are towards social justice, and how we articulate that from within our particular traditions.
And also, you mentioned a couple of times, and maybe you can talk a little bit about that more. There are a number of YouTube videos in which you speak about the personal ethical aspects of bringing your faith to life. Can you talk a little bit about that? How do you see that connection between spirituality and personal ethics and social ethics?
Well, it's about being consistent, right? I mean, it's one thing to talk about beliefs. It's one thing to have this personal, private relationship with God or to be uplifted or to fulfill obligations, religious obligations. But it's an entirely other thing, it seems, to actually live that in a way that you are exemplifying these principles. So in our tradition, in fact, and this is a good way to talk about what this event is that we have coming up.
Yes.
Within the Shia tradition, there's a long history of commemorating this tragedy and the martyrdom of Imam Hussein through a number of different acts. One is what's called the Majlis, where the events of the day or of that those particular 10 days are recounted, and those who are attending those events or those, you know, lectures will then weep and grieve and mourn. They'll either do some type of self-flagellation, and you'll often see photos of this online, and other ways expressing their grief. So that's one way in which people have done that. They've also done processions, and this is a tradition that's been going on for about 600 years or more. And what's interesting is that today, the youth and other members of the community say, you know, we don't want to just sit around and do, flagellation. We don't want to just cry. We want to put the principles of fighting for the underdog. We want to put the principles of fighting for social justice. We want to put these principles of service and servitude of like that Hussein exemplified into practice. So that's why you see events like Hussein Day and other organizations like Who is Hussein, where they're really committed towards doing acts of service, whether it be a blood drive, food drive, working with the needy, providing shelters and other kinds of humanitarian aid. these are have been the specific focus of organizations like this. So you can see that the Shia of today are in many ways saying, I want to go a little bit further than just commemorating. I don't want to just commemorate. I want to do something about it. I want to live these principles.
Let's just take a second. We have a couple of minutes left, but I wanted to ask you about gender and Islam. Islam is certainly caricatured in the West as repressive to women. Why does this caricature exist? Who's creating it and perpetuating it, and what can we do about it?
Well, that's a complicated discussion, and hence that's where I'm going with my PhD. But let's just say that today's Muslim women and communities are looking for ways in which to understand gender in an ethically based way. And we know that patriarchy and misogyny has no boundaries. It doesn't have religious boundaries. It doesn't have socioeconomic boundaries. It doesn't have cultural boundaries. You'll find the same types of behavior where men are perceived as superior in whatever ways, whether it be physically, whether it be spiritually, in all kinds of traditions and in all kinds of walks of life. In fact, we have still to achieve equal pay here in the United States, which the other day was Equal Pay Day. So there are many ways in which we see patriarchy and misogyny that exists in the world. It's not unique to Islam, and it's not unique to Muslim communities. But what's fascinating about the story of Hussein is that his sister, Zainab, was a very central figure in these events and in the remembrance of the events and in the political change even at the time of the tragedy. So her speeches and her presence in the courts of the rulers of the time, one of the governors, Ibn Ziyad, and then the leader, you know, the caliph, Yazid. So she spoke out against these individuals, and these speeches are recorded and commemorated. So the fact that a woman was present, vocal, and completely politically active and created change, political change, because it was through her activity, through her speaking out, that got these prisoners, herself and the other prisoners, to be released, is a fascinating example of women's presence within Islam. In fact, when you go back a little bit further, you see that when Imam Hussein even went to Karbala, he brought his entire family, all ages, all genders. There were people from different faiths who accompanied him, and there were other people of different ethnic backgrounds. So it was a very diverse group. And I think we can look back to that example and use that as a way to define our ethics today as a Shia Muslim community.
Nicole Carreri, thank you so much for this, for being with me. How can people find you online?
Well, I'm on all social media, and soon my website and Sunny app, Cultivating Our Humanity, will be up, and it will have a blog post. It will have links to lectures of mine, as well as a special project that I'm going to be working on called a Sexual Ethics Project. So I hope that your listeners will get a chance to meet me there, and they're certainly welcome to find me on Twitter and Instagram and Facebook.
And, of course, if they happen to be in Bellevue, Washington on April 28th, too. So, Nicole Carreri, thank you so much for being with me and for your important work. And congratulations on your graduation in May and your upcoming PhD program. I hope that goes well for you.
Thank you so much. Thank you. Look forward to meeting you as well, and good luck.
And this has been the Beloved Community. We're going to wrap it up. My guests have been, I wish to thank Nicole Carreri, Jeremy Roth-Kuschel, Lynn Neely of the Workers' World Party, and Brett Webb Mitchell. And check us out again on the second Friday of every month at 9 o'clock. I'm John Shuck. This is the Beloved Community on KBOO.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of Bright Moments with the Camas High School Choir on Friday, April 13th at 6:30 p.m. at the Portland Institute of Contemporary Art in Portland. This concert is a collaboration of the Camas High School Choir, indie rock musician Kelly Pratt, and young audiences of Oregon and Southwest Washington. The concert is an original hour-long performance for a rock band, horns, and 200 high school singers, blending together a wide array of styles and genres. Again, that's Bright Moments with the Camas High School Choir on Friday, April 13th at 6:30 p.m. at the Portland Institute of Contemporary Art, 15 Northeast Hancock Street in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
KBOO is celebrating 50 years of broadcasting and the many people who are part of KBOO's history.
I came down to the Salmon Street Studios, where the federal courthouse is, the first official home of KBOO.
Came into this rather bizarre situation where we were in the basement of an attorney's office.
And at that meeting, he said, well, I'm just going to let you know that when your lease is up in about 18 months, we will not renew your lease. We will extend it for up to 6 months at double the rent.
When I was hired, they said, we want to be on the air by the end of July. And I went, whoa, how much money do we have to pull this off? And they said, you know, we got $11,000. How are we going to build this facility with $11,000?
To hear the stories of people who helped make KBOO what it is today, go to 50yearsofkboo.fm and click on KBOO Stories Project.
And this is KBOO Portland, the Mighty Boo, Mighty 90.7. It's about 10 o'clock in the a.m., which means we'll be going to Valley Views in a moment. We'll be hearing from the program manager at Edible Corvallis Initiative and the Corvallis Environmental Center. We'll wrap up the hour with an encore presentation of yesterday's Flashpoints that aired yesterday evening on KPFA in Berkeley. We thank the Pacifica Foundation for sharing that with us, our siblings in struggle in regional solidarity. At 11, the Digital Divide talks about Facebook.